From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley. We're less than a week from Thanksgiving, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recommending that you stay home and only celebrate with people you've lived with for the past 2 weeks. For more on how you can celebrate this holiday safely, let's bring in Aaron Bromage. He's Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's on Skype. And Professor, first off, why is this CDC recommendation necessary?
Well, there's really two recommendations there is stay home and keep your family, you know, household to one. So we know with people traveling, it's just going to either spread infection on the front side as you're going there, or on the other side, after Thanksgiving, you're going to bring it back to your own community. But then in your own home, what we are seeing, you know, in Massachusetts, the data is really quite clear that the vast majority of new infections are happening in your home. So you bring a single person into your house, that one person is infected and they end up infecting 4, 5, or if you're having a Thanksgiving gathering, 8, 9, 10 other people in your house.
What if people are intent on seeing each other and they want to get tested and then get together? Is there a way to do that safely? Because getting a negative test one day does not necessarily cover all of your bases.
Right. And I will admit I am exactly in the same category too, because my wife's mother, we would like to have her here for Thanksgiving. And we are pulling our hair out on how we can do this safely. And there is no safe in amongst this, but how can you lower the risk? And it really is lowering your interactions down to just the lowest risk interactions you can have in the week leading up to Thanksgiving. So no going to restaurants, no going to bars, limit grocery shopping, and then a test as close to Thanksgiving as you possibly can with a result. So there is a path to do it, but can people really do 7 days of low interactions and get a test with a result that comes back in time? And that's, you know, one of the tough things with it.
But there are other considerations. What about a family that has a college student coming home, for instance, and their college student can't stay in the dorms? How can families like that manage that type of situation?
Yeah, and so this is really incumbent on the college to make sure they're doing it right and not spreading it around the country. But again, what can the college student do is, if they're not already, their interaction should be virtually nothing for the next 4 or 5 days. Then they need to take a test before they leave the school. And, you know, they could take the test and drive home, but then they need to isolate themselves away from the rest of their family until at least they get the result, but preferably lower the type of interactions that you're having for, you know, a week or two after you come back. Open a window, open a door, even a crack or two makes an enormous difference in the amount of virus that could build up in the air and infecting others.
Let's fast forward a week. The turkey's gone for people that don't follow these guidelines and do attend family gatherings outside of their bubbles. What should they do? Should they be quarantining?
Yeah, if you are adamant that you are going to have your 10-person, you know, feast and enjoy it and have fun with your family, and I get why you're doing it, you then have a responsibility to make sure that you don't take that personal risk and move it around in the community. And so, again, you should be lowering interactions down in the weeks after that and getting a test where you can. My kids' school is doing something very similar to this. Today is their last day, and they're not going back to Wednesday. And everybody on the Monday has to drive past the school and get a test, and it has to be cleared before they're allowed to come back on the Wednesday. So there are things that you need to do to make sure that you are not bringing your risk from your own choices into the community and infecting others.
Have you come to a resolution on your mother-in-law coming to visit?
Yeah, so it's going to happen. I have spent about $1,000 on making my home ready. I have two enormous HEPA filters in my house. My wife and I both got tested yesterday, you know, pulling our kids out of school. We have got a carbon dioxide monitor in the house now to know that we're getting the right air exchanges. But I'm terrified. I mean, I've never been said that I'm fearful of this before, but this does worry me. But I've done the best that I can do. We have to now live with the risk that we are now facing. And it's tough. And I'm conflicted with this literally every single day.
But ultimately, you're telling people if you don't have to take that risk, you shouldn't.
Right. And I don't understand the longer distance travel to do this, because there's such a big travel issue with flying or buses or trains or however you're getting around. And then bringing two households together is risky. You add a 50% risk by adding a third household, and it just keeps going up the more people you put together.
Aaron Bromage is Associate Professor of Biology at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Thank you so much for joining us, and you have a good and safe Thanksgiving.
Thank you for having me on your show, and you have a great Thanksgiving as well.
Well, it won't be ready in time for Thanksgiving, but this week the FDA approved a new at-home test for COVID-19, which promises results in less than half an hour. Dr. Gary Prokop is Medical Director of Clinical Virology at the Cleveland Clinic, which ran a clinical trial for the new test. Dr. Prokop, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And before we talk about what this will mean in terms of public health, let's talk about the test kit itself. What does it look like? How does it work?
Yeah, so the test kit's pretty simple. You get a kit, and it has a little machine inside, and it has a swab, it has a vial, and it has instructions. And so basically, you swab both sides of your nose, and then you put the swab into the vial and swirl it again. And then you're going to put it in this little instrument that comes with two AA batteries and let it go. And it will run itself for up to 30 minutes. And there's a positive light and a negative light. And if all the lights flash, it tells you that there was an error, and a little baggie to dispose all of it when you're done.
So I guess the question is, when those lights flash, positive or negative, how much can we rely on them? Is it as good as going to a test center or to a doctor's office?
I would say it's in the very good category. So they did three arms to this trial. And in their community testing arm, they essentially tested 101 patients, and they only missed three. And the three that they missed had low viral loads, right? So we know in this disease that once you get infected, your viral load will rise. Then as you recover, your viral load will start to drop. So those are the only ones that they missed. So it looks like it's a very good test for people who have acute COVID-19 early in disease. If you start testing asymptomatic people, these tests don't perform up to the documented standards. They're all cleared for symptomatic people. And the quick tests like this, they tend to start breaking down when you start testing people with low viral loads, which would be asymptomatic folks. So it's pretty important that people are really only testing themselves with this or any of the other quick tests if they're symptomatic.
How big of a development is this? In other words, could access to home testing be an important weapon against this pandemic?
I'm excited about it for a couple reasons. One is it keeps sick people in their homes, right? We want sick people to be isolated and not transmitting the virus. Number two is it decreases the use of personal protective equipment. So you don't have to have a nurse or other caregiver, gown, glove, mask in order to swab a patient. They're doing it in the safety of their own home. You know, the challenge will be to the company to gear up, you know, get these products into our hands. And I think it also is a herald to other companies that this can be done.
Another challenge that might present itself here is that it's by prescription only. Patients taking the test at home are going to be responsible for reporting their results to the doctor. And then the doctor, as far as I understand, will then have to report those results to health officials. Just wonder if you run the risk of losing track along the way, if that could be an issue.
Yeah, you really do. I mean, I think you point out an important challenge. We need to know who has COVID-19 so public health officials can do their job of contact tracing. That's going to have to be a portion of this home testing that really gets nailed down, pretty firmly.
Doctor, regarding the reliability of these tests, if someone gets a negative result, do you have any concern that they might, you know, then think they're home free, not take the precautions that they might need to anyways?
You know, that getting a negative result, if somebody's symptomatic, they should always question that negative result. And this company and, you know, other companies too, I think, have put very good language in their test directions. Like, for example, this one says negative results do not preclude the SARS-CoV-2 infection. Individuals who test negative and continue to experience COVID-like symptoms should seek follow-up care from their healthcare provider. So we know that very early in disease, the viral load is going to be low because you just got infected. And so any test can miss people at those very low viral load levels. So as patients become symptomatic, if symptoms become worse, you know, they should consider getting tested again, maybe getting tested with a more sensitive test, and for sure stay in contact with their medical provider.
The other thing I'm wondering is, will it be irrelevant by the time a vaccine rolls out to the general public, maybe around the same time that this home test becomes widely available?
Yeah, I don't know. Time will tell. Everybody for sure is really hoping these vaccines are going to be highly effective. So, but until we know for sure, you know, it's another good test that I think we can add to a list of the good tests that we have. So, you know, happy to have it.
Dr. Gary Prokop, whose lab at the Cleveland Clinic was involved in the clinical trials for Lucira Health's new COVID-19 home test kit approved this week by the FDA. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The coronavirus isn't the only problem America is facing right now. Last year, a record number of people died from drug overdoses, roughly 71,000, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And this year is on track to set another record. Most people are dying due to fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that often comes from China. The Trump administration promised to stop the flow of fentanyl into the United States, but NPR has found trafficking has actually increased. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann joins me now to talk all about this. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Tanya.
Brian, you've reported that this synthetic opioid fentanyl has surged in states like California and Arizona. Why is it surging specifically on the West Coast? And remind us of this drug and exactly why it's so addictive.
Yeah. So fentanyl has been around for a while, street fentanyl. It's this incredibly addictive, chemically made version of opioids. It's sort of like morphine, but it's 50 to 100 times more powerful. And for a long time, one wrinkle, one good bit of news was that it didn't spread very much in the Western U.S. Largely, that's because it didn't mix very well with the kind of street heroin that people suffering from addiction in the Western U.S. tend to use. So there was sort of a way to stop it coming in. But the last couple of years, researchers have found that more drug smugglers are bringing fentanyl into these communities, and they're selling it so cheaply that people are beginning to switch over. I want to introduce you to a guy named Jake, who I interviewed in Phoenix, Arizona, on the street. I actually met him while he was on his way to buy more fentanyl.
I used to shoot up heroin, and then when I got out, I just started, you know, smoking pills because that was the thing that was around. It was so easy to get pills, so I just started smoking pills.
So basically what he's saying there, Tanya, is, you know, that these fentanyl pills coming north from Mexico, they were cheaper than heroin, easier to get, and so now his addiction has changed.
As I mentioned, a lot of this fentanyl comes from China. The government there banned the export of fentanyl last year under pressure from the Trump administration. Has that helped?
Yeah, NPR looked really closely at this, Tanya. And what we found is that Chinese chemical companies that were exporting fentanyl have instead begun selling what are known as fentanyl precursor chemicals. These are the raw chemicals that are used to make this drug. And what these companies have done is adapt. They've taken to using social media to sell directly still into the United States. But the bigger change, and this is something that the Drug Enforcement Administration is also raising alarm about, is that these Chinese companies are selling directly to drug cartels in Mexico. And so more and more those drug cartels are using their supply routes, their street markets, to pump fentanyl into more of these cities, like Phoenix, like Los Angeles, like Seattle. So while direct shipments from China did drop, what we're seeing is this whole new deadly pipeline that's been created in its place.
Meanwhile, Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, settled with the Justice Department for more than $8 billion. That deal was approved this week by a federal bankruptcy judge. A lot of that money is supposed to go help fund treatment programs and other efforts to mitigate the opioid epidemic. I mean, could it help? Is this really enough?
Yeah, this is interesting. Of course, Purdue Pharma really involved in seeding this opioid epidemic back in the late 90s with the sale of OxyContin and drugs that sort of started people down this deadly path. And now the question is whether this company can route enough money out to communities to pay for drug addiction treatment programs, homeless programs, all the things that are needed to help with this opioid epidemic. And communities we're talking to say, yes, they desperately need this money. They need as much help as they can get. But it's important to remember, Tanya, that the cost of the opioid epidemic is now calculated in the trillions of dollars. It has devastated so many people, so many communities. So $8.3 billion, it sounds like a lot of money, but everyone we talk to say it is a drop in the bucket.
I mean, and just a side note to ask you, where is this money coming from? We know Purdue Pharma is in bankruptcy.
Yeah, this is a really complicated wrinkle, and it's very controversial. Purdue Pharma is in bankruptcy, and so the idea that this bankruptcy judge approved this week is that the company will be reinvented as what's called a public benefit corporation. It'll essentially exist to generate profits from opioid sales. Those profits will then fund drug treatment programs, right? And so that's a relationship that a lot of people, including many state attorneys general, a lot of members of Congress, they think is profoundly dangerous and unethical. It essentially will put all of these communities that have been poisoned by opioids into a long-term dependency relationship with this company and its profits to pay for rehab and treatment. And so, yes, if this $8.3 billion ever materializes, a lot of that money will flow directly from future sale of pills like OxyContin.
Okay, so there have been no criminal charges filed against the members of the Sackler family who own Purdue Pharma. They pocketed as much as $13 billion from the sale of opioids. Under this agreement with the Justice Department, they've admitted no wrongdoing, and they're giving up around $225 million of their personal wealth. How are people involved or impacted reacting to that?
They're not happy. I mean, this, remember, Tanya, this opioid epidemic now has sort of one family viewed as being right involved at the epicenter of it. The Sacklers created Purdue Pharma. They marketed OxyContin aggressively. And now, under this arrangement as it exists, they will give up a tiny fraction of their fabulous wealth. I should say that there are a lot of state attorneys general who say they're not going to go along with this deal. They're still trying to sue the Sackler family directly. And the Justice Department does say that criminal charges against members of the family are still possible in the future. Remember, tens of thousands of people have died in overdoses linked to OxyContin. But a lot of the legal experts NPR has been talking to say they really don't expect to see the Sacklers brought up on criminal charges. They think that's very unlikely.
That's Brian Mann, NPR addiction correspondent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
MSNBC host Rachel Maddow returned to her show last night and shared a blunt warning for viewers, revealing that her longtime partner, Susan, almost died of COVID-19.
I would have done anything. I would have moved mountains for it to have been me who was sick these past couple of weeks instead of Susan. I still would give anything for that. But this thing does not give you that choice.
Rachel Maddow's warning is now trending on social media. And let's start our weekly social media roundup on that note with Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. And Femi, by sharing her family's story, Maddow actually warns listeners to consider their loved ones when calculating risk. She's been getting a lot of support online. What are you seeing?
Well, it was a love story that she shared, and people responded almost instantly the moment she shared that story. Let me give you a few examples. Susan posted, "Thank you for being vulnerable and sharing this. People need to know what they're risking because they really don't until someone they love gets sick." Serene Wright is very empathetic. "I so feel you. My 88-year-old dad has COVID. He's on the East Coast and I can't fly in without a forced two-week quarantine." She shares more of her personal story. Not all empathy, though, out there, as Rachel Maddow is quite a polarizing figure from her MSNBC show. Kathleen is very direct. Was she wearing a mask, talking about Maddow's partner? Guessing she was. Still got it. I'm sure she'd be fine, calm down. And Mika Yo points out, well, how healthy was your partner, but in a less polite way. But however people are seeing it, they were prompted to really respond, because Rachel Maddow, she just spilled her heart out to the camera. Mm-hmm. And at one point, there's a noise in her house. She's working from home. She's broadcasting from home. And there's a noise from her house. She leaves the camera, goes off, fixes the noise, comes back, and you're waiting. You're waiting to hear what she has to say next. You can hear what she had to say at Maddow Blog on Twitter.
I want to ask you about something else also trending on social media. The actions of a man in Michigan is getting a lot of attention. Ned Stabler is the head of TechTown, a startup incubator in Detroit, and he gave a passionate speech to the Republican members of the Wayne County Elections Board on Tuesday about certifying the ballots for president in that county, which includes Detroit, as President Trump challenges Joe Biden's win in Michigan. Let's listen to a clip.
The law isn't on your side. History won't be on your side. Your conscience will not be on your side. And Lord knows, when you go to meet your maker, your soul is going to be very, very warm.
Femi, those Republican board members had refused to certify votes from Detroit, a city that is predominantly black, but quickly reversed after criticism, as we know, from people like Ned. Some on social media now see him as a hero, others a villain. What are you saying?
Yeah, he got a virtual standing ovation from so many people. You can find him on the Reddit public freakout section. I think that what he did really kind of embodies that idea of speaking out when something really moves you. But from the villain camp, Kathy says, well, he's an unstable lefty. And she doesn't think that he should be talking in that way. He threatens people that don't think the way he does. John Smith accused him of race baiting, but most people just really appreciated that he took his moment. Ned's response on Twitter, folks, I appreciate the love, but it wasn't me that got the Wayne County Board of Canvassers to reverse their decision. It was us, and mostly it was powerful people of color demanding their rights. I'm giving Ned the last word on that one.
Femi Yoke is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. As always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
There's an unusual tug of war between the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve that could leave businesses in the lurch now that we're entering a new round of coronavirus restrictions and closures. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin sent a letter yesterday asking the Fed to return unspent money Congress had allocated for emergency lending programs in the first relief bill. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, for more. Hey, Ali.
Hey, Tanya.
First of all, how much money are we talking about? What was the Fed using it for?
So this is an interesting story. I'm not even sure why this is happening right now, but it's a lot of money. It's $455 billion in what Mnuchin calls unused funding. Now, by getting this money back from the Fed, it would end the Fed's emergency lending program, which involves loans to state and local governments. Remember, they've had cutbacks because of COVID, and to mid-sized businesses all the way through the Main Street Business Lending Program. This money was put out in the CARES Act, which is the first bill that went out. It includes $195 billion that the Fed had already committed to specific programs. But we're talking about $455 billion, almost half $1 trillion.
Yeah. Mnuchin's request sparked rare criticism from Fed Chair Jerome Powell, who said the central bank needs this money as an important safety net. What was Mnuchin's reasoning?
Well, he says that Congress intended for these funds to expire on December 31st. Now, remember, when we first did this CARES Act, not a lot of people thought we'd still be talking about this at this level by November. That is the deadline that the act set. And he said that the Fed's intervention has already, in his words, achieved its objective. Part of the problem is he's using markets as a gauge for this. He said markets have responded positively and banks have continued lending. The problem is a lot of these Main Street businesses that are suffering are not reflected in the stock market at all. Mnuchin's saying we don't need the money anymore. Give it back to the federal government. Again, as an outgoing Treasury Secretary with an outgoing administration, it's not clear to me why they're doing this right now, but it has created an unusual battle between the Fed and the Treasury.
Okay, to gain a little bit more understanding, Republican lawmakers are arguing that Fed programs were meant to be temporary, but the economy as we know is floundering again as talks on this new relief package are stalled. What does removing those programs actually mean for the long-term recovery and the Fed's role?
Well, one economist likened it to taking away the lifeboats at the Titanic. His point was, you know, when the boat left the dock, nobody needed the lifeboats. Mm-hmm. But when you needed them and they weren't there, that would be a problem. It's not easy for the Fed to get this money. It has to be done by an act of Congress. As we know, the Senate has already left for the Thanksgiving holiday. We're going to be in a lame duck session. And things are getting worse out there with COVID. The number of infections are increasing. The number of deaths are increasing. Closures are coming again. So the sense is that if you take this flexibility away from the Federal Reserve and things get really bad, a new president, probably Joe Biden, is going to have to start negotiations again, and it could be months before you get it out there again. So why don't you leave the money with the Fed if in case it's necessary?
Okay, 30 seconds. If the Fed does give up the money, could it be used by Congress for the next relief package?
It would have to be reallocated. So Joe Biden would have to start new negotiations with Congress. He would probably get that done with the House. But again, depending on what happens in the Senate, which we won't know who controls the Senate until the Georgia runoffs in January 5th, this could be a protracted battle again to get more money to businesses.
That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. As always, thank you.
Okay.
I spent some time on a lettuce farm recently, where tractors are busy digging furrows in the dirt. This region in southwest Arizona is called the Salad Bowl of America. 90% of the country's winter lettuce is grown right here in the fields around Yuma. And farmer John Boltz says the lettuce we're standing in front of could soon be in front of you.
Oh, gosh, it could go anywhere across the U.S. and Canada. And if I was traveling around the country and ordered myself up a Caesar salad, or anybody out there listening, you know, could end up on any of their plates or what have you. We're stepping out into a romaine lettuce field here. Water is a precious natural resource that we depend on to be able to grow these crops. As the old adage goes, you know, food grows where water flows. And right here in this field, water is flowing down these furrows to irrigate this crop.
We're literally walking towards it right now.
We are, yeah. Lettuce is mostly made of water, upwards of 90% made of water.
And all this water is coming from a canal that comes from the Colorado River, which really isn't that far away from here.
Yeah, it's all, it's an amazing system. It moves by gravity, extremely efficient. It's one of the reasons why food is so affordable in our country, is that we're literally standing on the shoulders of giants that came 50, 100, 150 years before us that put in this infrastructure.
Here comes the water. We better get out of the way.
Yeah.
This is a unique time to be a farmer in America. Boltz is wearing a mask to protect against COVID-19. He's a Trump supporter.
I have one vote. My wife has one vote. But regardless of who gets elected, our biggest thing is that we're going to work with those people to make sure that we're able to continue to produce what the American people need. And that's what our great American Republican democracy is about.
Still, Boltz will be sorry to see the Republican president go. He liked to see President Trump cutting regulations. He doesn't mind the trade war with China.
We grow cotton and we grow some other crops that are traded beyond the borders of the United States. I know a lot of people in my profession across the country were not in favor of the tariffs. But I think most people do appreciate that are in farming, do appreciate that an administration was trying to bring a little bit of balance back to a pretty hefty imbalance as far as trade has been happening.
The economy's tough. We're in the middle of a pandemic. How are you doing? How is business down here?
Well, the last year for us has been very similar to everybody else. The products we grow in the winter months down here They won't store in a grain bin. They don't sit on a shelf waiting for people to buy them. They have a 2 to 3 week shelf life at best. So when we see places around the country shut down, restaurants shut down, we saw billions of dollars go to waste. The natural resources that went into growing those crops go to waste. Lots of knee-jerk reactions that maybe didn't make a lot of sense.
In terms of the shutdowns?
As far as lockdowns, shutdowns, however you want to describe it. So it's been a very challenging year.
Bolt still knows the risk is growing as COVID erupts across the country, and I could see that his workers were being careful as another tractor rolled by.
You know, I noticed the guys in the tractors, in the cabs there, wearing masks.
Yeah, they have to get out from time to time and adjust things. They have to get out and talk to guys, and it's just some of them find it's easier not to take it off and put it back on all the time. You know,
but that's your policy on the farm?
Yeah, we're using masks when we're having to work together. You know, it's a big deal to us to make sure our workers stay safe.
Well, I hear you, but you know, as you well know, the agriculture community has been sort of in the spotlight during the pandemic at places like fish houses and meat processing plants and in fields like this because, well, people may be working outside. You know, I noticed some men working in the field out here on my way over, and there was a big bus that they all came in together, I could tell. So do you think your workers feel safe?
I think they do. I had one of them ask me, how did you know that the outbreak would get this bad? Why did you work so hard to help prepare all of us as employees to, you know, employ the right practices and everything? And I said, well, you look at the science, you look at the best advice from the experts. We took that advice and we put it into practice.
California has seen deadly outbreaks of COVID-19 on its farms. When I asked the Yuma County Health Department if this area has seen any, the answer was not yet. But let's put that into context. 50,000 workers descend on the region every winter, many of them on temporary work visas from Mexico. They pick lettuce by hand in the sun, fix sprinklers like the one you hear watering this field. The workers package produce and ship it off to restaurants and grocery stores around the country. The health department says it's partnering with a group to offer testing, housing, and health checks for workers who do get sick. But for people like Emma Torres, all the uncertainty leaves an ugly question hanging in the air.
Well, right now, what if?
As in, what if there's an outbreak? Torres is director of a local farm worker advocacy group called Campesinos Sin Fronteras.
We think about basic hygiene, and they say wash your hands or every time they go to the bathroom and all that. But if it's not available, if water and soap is not available, if there is not a clean bathroom, is that all those, then that should be a concern in that scenario.
Are you hearing that from workers?
Well, I don't hear it. I have seen it. So it's been, I grew up being a farm worker myself. So, you know, I am familiar with, you know, how the environment is.
Is there any way to know if there's outbreaks happening within this worker community if nobody's testing them? I mean, is there widespread testing going on the farms?
What happened, Peter, was that when COVID started and everybody were sheltered at home and all that, that was last March 15 or something like that, our agriculture season was ending at that time. So we didn't see a lot of that. And so last time, not here because the work ended, but in Salinas we heard. In Santa Maria we heard of the outbreaks.
In California.
And these are the same workers that we work with. They migrate upstream. So we have not seen it because they have not been here.
Interesting. But the season is picking up now.
It's picking up right now. So we don't know. That's why I was saying at the beginning, I don't know. We're praying and hoping that it won't. And again, but not just praying and hoping, but we're being proactive and, again, given organizing ourselves to provide information and the PPE to prevent from being infected because we don't want an outbreak. Nobody wants an outbreak, definitely, you know, because that will be very disastrous for our ag industry.
So in a way, the virus is on the doorstep, just waiting for a chance to get in. Torres says she's concerned about all those farm buses that carry workers every day from the border to the fields. The passengers appear worried, too. I saw many of them covering their entire faces so only their eyes were showing.
And when they travel in these enclosed vehicles, 30 or more of them, for half an hour or an hour, their risk increases.
And she worries about the long lines on the Mexican side of the border where workers gather at the port, shoulder to shoulder, waiting to cross before dawn.
I guess it is very concerning to me, because there should be maybe a faster line where they don't have to like be staying there for hours, standing, you know, one after the other, and because it is a risk for them and for us.
Add it all up, and it's exhausting work, even without a pandemic.
What can I tell you? Farm workers have it always tough, because they don't have a year-round job. They don't have a job that provides them fringe benefits. They don't have health insurance. Very few of them, you know, there's a small percentage, maybe 30, 40% of people that might have health insurance while they're working. They say that for them, they don't even notice something being worse than the other, because they've been always under this precarious conditions, living under precarious conditions.
So now a new administration is coming in. What's your message to Joe Biden from farm workers in Yuma, Arizona?
Well, my message is that as a farm worker population is being now deemed essential, that they would be given them the same attention as other essential workers, provide them with the benefits, with health insurance, you know, that they deserve. We need to have a healthy workforce, you know, that's all. So that's where I see that we have a common ground with the agricultural industry, that because they want a healthy workforce. We want a healthy workforce.
Makes sense, considering how much we rely on these farms in Yuma for the food we'll be eating this winter.
That's the one and only Will Smith performing the opening rap to Fresh Prince of Bel-Air for a reunion special that HBO released this week to mark the show's 30th anniversary. And that's not the only news in the world of TV nostalgia. The Peanuts holiday specials won't be on network TV this year. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
So let's start with the Fresh Prince reunion. Will Smith hosts a conversation with the cast, the main cast, as they celebrate the show's 30th year anniversary. I got really geek seeing the promos on Instagram. I still can't believe that it's been 30 years. What do you think? Is this must-watch TV?
Oh, if you're a fan of the show, you gotta watch this. Will Smith is, of course, the de facto host, bringing together all the folks who used to be on the show, except for James Avery, who played his uncle, who died. Mm-hmm. But Will Smith tells a story about how Quincy Jones had him audition for the show during Quincy Jones' birthday party in his house. And Will Smith didn't want to do it. He wanted some time to prepare because he'd never acted before. And Quincy pulls him to the side and says, look, everybody who needs to say yes to this show is in that next room waiting for you. And it was just
what
like, okay.
Story.
And then Alfonso Ribeiro, who played Carlton, goes, how did I know you for 30 years and not hear that story? So that's not necessarily a story that a lot of people have heard. But he told that story, and there's a lot of great reminiscing about what the show means, because it was a way of sort of taking all this, the energy of all this rap culture that was going on, and presenting it on network TV in a way that was, frankly, you know, relatively safe, but also a way that young people felt like their culture was being represented in this sitcom. It was a more powerful show than I think we even realized when it was on the air.
Yeah. Well, this special also features a conversation between Will and Janet Hubert, the original Aunt Viv, who left the show really on bad terms. I mean, your NPR colleague, Aisha Harris, wrote a moving and nuanced piece about what Janet went through on the show. What's it like seeing these two actors reunited after decades of what we have heard as bitter resentment?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it's like, it would have been weird if they had done the reunion without having her on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had to sort of figure out a way to sort of reconcile her experience. There was always this sense, you know, she had a very bitter departure from the show. What was sort of talked about amongst fans was that she was fired. So the two of them come together and they kind of admit that they didn't really understand what the other person was going through. There's a great clip where she kind of confronts him about what happened, and let's play a little bit of it.
Hollywood disowned me. My family said, you've ruined our name. And I wasn't unprofessional on the set. I just stopped talking to everybody because I didn't know who to trust because I had been banished. And they said it was you who banished me. And I understand you were able to move forward, but you know those words, calling a black woman difficult in Hollywood is the kiss of death. Mm-hmm. It's the kiss of death. And it's hard enough being a dark-skinned black woman in this business.
Mm. And so that was important. You know, her saying, you know, I'm an older, dark-skinned black woman, and me losing this job, you know, essentially killed my career. You know, for fans of the show, I think it would just be an amazing moment to see.
I'm gearing up to watch that for sure. Okay, something else that a lot of folks watch during this season are the Peanuts holiday specials. Here's a sample of their Thanksgiving TV classic.
What's all the commotion?
We've got another holiday to worry about. It seems Thanksgiving Day is upon us.
I haven't even finished eating all my Halloween candy!
I can sympathize, Sally.
Yeah, exactly. But these specials we broadcast differently this year, thanks to Apple, much to the chagrin of viewers who look forward to them. What's going on here?
So, yeah, so basically Apple bought the rights to distribute the series. Mm-hmm. There was a huge backlash to this. So Apple set up something where they're providing the Thanksgiving special and the Christmas special to PBS and PBS Kids. Mm. They're going to have a couple days where they get to do that. And then Apple TV Plus is also going to make it available for free on streaming for a couple of days. You know, I've been talking with people on social media, and they kind of feel like these films are almost public domain. Like they've been used to being able to watch them whenever the holiday rolls around, that they feel any sense that they're placed somewhere where you have to pay to see them is kind of an affront. You know, something like this just reminds us that sometimes even our most treasured and sentimental media are the creations of big companies or owned by big companies that will do whatever they feel they need to do to leverage the most profit off of them. Mm. That's kind of a depressing Thanksgiving message, isn't it? Sorry about that. But, you know, hey, that's life in the big media city.
On that note, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, as always. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.